seated.
Court is ready to hear argument in 041039, Fluker Tire and Rubber Company versus Oscar Mendez and others.
May it please the court, Bruce Melides will present argument for the petition. The petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, there are, as I see it, three primary issues here that are dispositive in one way or the other, as well as some other issues that were raised in the brief. And so I intend to concentrate this morning on the charge error, the legal insufficiency of the evidence to support a causal defect finding, which necessarily includes some challenges to some expert testimony.
I'm curious as to why in that order, because evidence review would preclude inquiry into the other, into the former.
Well, except that I think both of those points, under the circumstances of this case, can be rendition points. So, I mean, they just were on my outline in that order. I can take them in whatever order the court would like. They pretty much involve a lot of the same issues, such as what are the elements of a manufacturing defect claim, et cetera. The plaintiff's theory in this case, from opening statements, or even before that, from Bourdier through closing arguments, was that the manufacturing defect in this case was wax that was allegedly placed on the belts of belt material as they went through certain bias coders. And so keep that in mind when I talk about some of this testimony. Now,
when you say in your reply brief that they're really arguing an indeterminate defect, like we had in Ridgeway.
Yes. I think that's what the trial court submitted.
Well, and so you said, but you say, well, no, it was the wax, and then you say, well, no, it might be indeterminate.
Well, no, what they're arguing on appeal, I mean, well, it's not so much that they're really arguing it, that's what the trial court did. And in the motions, in the post-verdict motion hearings, we argued that you have, that the plaintiff has the burden of proof to come forward with some deviation from specifications in order to get to the jury on a manufacturing defect claim, and they didn't do that here. In fact, the specifications weren't admitted into evidence. Although Cooper gave up certain specifications, none of them were given to the experts. They didn't even review them. And there's no testimony. This is what I think is critical. There were two other tires on the vehicle that were made by Cooper, same model, made the same week at the same plant. So you had two exemplars on the vehicle. There was no comparison in any meaningful way with the subject tire versus the other ones except for some x-rays, and the only difference was the subject tire had a nail hole and the other two did not. What the trial court submitted was the PJC submission for manufacturing defect, and it simply says that a defect is a condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous. It doesn't
Counsel,
require...
Was there any evidence of any defect other than the manufacturing defect?
Yes, there was some evidence from Rex Grogan. He testified that, and I don't understand the testimony. I don't understand exactly what he was talking about, but he said that, you know, that there were design problems when you didn't match up the belts properly, but that was a design issue. You didn't want areas of steel, because these cords, if you look at them cut, you've got belt material. The belt material cut has steel cords running through it encased in rubber. And so he said when you cut it, you don't want it so that there could be a weakness in that splice. But he clearly said in the testimony that we attached to our reply brief that that was a design issue. There was no design defect question submitted because there was no testimony admitted on a safer alternative design. So, and I think what part of their argument also was that a tire is defective if, at trial I'm talking about, that a tire is defective if it fails before all of its tread is gone. And that's not supported by the evidence, and multiple courts around the country have said that that's nothing more than accident or failure equals defect, which in tire cases can't be, since so many things other than defect, one of which was present in the tire here, can cause the tire to fail. In Texas, we have three categories of defect. Each of those categories have different elements.
Well, wasn't it clear, though, at trial that the defect they were after was the separation of the tire?
But, Your Honor, a tire separates for many, many reasons.
I understand. But it was clear that the separation is what they were claiming caused the accident. There was no doubt about what the flaw was.
Well, but a separation, their own experts agreed that simply because it separated does not mean that there was a manufacturing defect in the tire. Everybody agreed with that. The question in this, nobody disputed that it separated. The dispute was the separation caused by a manufacturing defect present at the time of manufacture 3 years before the accident, or because of the puncture that was in it?
Well, can you tell me what planned output means? Because you're talking about specifications, but it also cannot conform to planned output and be a manufacturing defect. What does planned output mean?
Well, I think planned output, to me, with certain products, planned output is the same thing as specifications. In Grinnell, the court said that, well, the fact that there's pesticide in most tobacco leaves, and therefore in most cigarettes, is still a manufacturing defect because the manufacturer didn't intend for its cigarettes to have it there. This is a completely different problem in this case because wax is an intended ingredient of tires. And it's undisputed that wax migrates. So the simple fact that you find wax on the tire, which is all that they found, doesn't mean that it's defective.
I understand that, but I haven't read the record, but my understanding is the complaint is that in the vulcanization process, the steel and the rubber are supposed to fuse. And if that fusion doesn't happen, it's a problem with the planned output.
That may be. But, however, in Texas, you've got to submit it. You can't just submit the case as some vague defect. Because, for example, vulcanization, that occurs in a mold under pressure over time and high temperatures. The tire could not fuse because the machine was broken and the temperature never got high enough. That would be a manufacturing defect because it wasn't cured to the specification. But it could also not cure because the specification itself had too low of a temperature. And you have to decide which is which, because if it's a design problem, by statute, they have to come up with an alternative curing spec.
And you gave them the specification they needed to make that determination.
Yes. And I mean, again, here, the problem is in Torrington, for example, where the planned output language also sort of arises, there was no dispute in that case that there was contamination.
You said that nobody disputes the bell separated. That's an agreed-to fact.
That's an agreed-to fact.
You can see that the separation at least contributed to the rollover.
Well, in the same way, I guess, that if there'd been no separation, I don't think it contributed. We don't concede that it contributed to the rollover. Because the testimony is that only a very, very small percentage of tire disablements lead to automobile accidents. Something between 95 to 99% of all tire disablements do not result in an accident. So that statistic, to which the plaintiff's experts agreed, means that they have to come forward with evidence to show why this case was different.
Does Cooper concede that a nail puncture would not cause a properly manufactured tire to suffer belt separation?
It could. Not. I guess what I'm saying that It's not our position that all punctures always lead to tread belt separation. They can also lead to blowouts.
Does Cooper concede that a properly manufactured tire with 30,000 miles on it should not suffer belt separation?
I'm not just unqualified. I don't know that I can answer that because a tire that is properly manufactured, properly maintained, doesn't get punctured, isn't run underinflated, should last. But the plain fact of the matter here is this tire had an unrepaired nail hole. And if you look at the expert testimony in this case, they don't have an expert that's qualified to testify.
Is that your theory on why the belt separated as the nail puncture?
That was the testimony of our experts. I think most of the testimony was going to rebut. We don't have a burden to explain why it detreaded. They have a burden to demonstrate that it was due to a manufacturing defect. If the standard is going to be in Texas that all tires have to last until they get down to that 230 seconds or 330 seconds, whatever it is, then we're really going to have a situation where the manufacturer becomes an insurer of his product, which Texas law has never recognized.
What if the tire had 3 miles on it and was 3 minutes old?
No nail puncture. Different question. Because I think as this court noted...
The question this way. If the tire were 3 minutes old, had 3 miles on it, would you still assert that there needs to be evidence of whether the specifications, what the specifications were and whether they were complied with?
I think that's the sort of case that Section 3 of the Restatement Third was designed for, a virtually brand new product that fails under normal use. But you can't have an indeterminate defect when you've already got something in the tire that the experts say could cause exactly what happened in this case. Now, there is testimony.
And that being?
The nail hole.
If there were no nail hole, all the other facts were the same, how would that change your argument?
I think there was also evidence of the tire being run underinflated in this case. And I guess I don't see that the court really should even get to weighing this, because this isn't a weighing issue in this case. None of the expert testimony in this case can survive either Robinson, Gamble, Havner, or the court's most recent case, BW versus Ramirez, which I think is the closest to this.
So let me ask you one question before you move on to that about the charge. And while I might be inclined to agree with you that it should be clarified to refer to deviant from specifications or something like that, in a case where we just ask you about a Ridgeway type case where the case was where the tire was brand new, it would be very hard to see that was a harmful error because everything else was ruled out. You just put the tire on the ground and the tread came off. But in a case, I don't know if this was one, but in a case where the evidence is not about design defect or marketing defect, it's not about anything but manufacturing defect, how is it harmful just to say manufacturing defect and not refer to a deviation from specifications or planned output?
Because the testimony was not undisputed, like it was in Torrington, on the issue of whether or not there was in fact a deviation. And so a jury can find, they might just think, oh, the condition is that it failed at all. I don't think tires should fail when they still have tread on the highway, which is what has been argued on appeal.
Well, but the question directs the jury's attention to when it left the plant. Was it defective when it left the plant? Mm-hmm. So why were they not focused on output there? I mean, I understand if the question just said, was there a flaw in the tire caused the accident? But it focuses the jury on when it left the plant.
But all three types, if you look at the PJC, the question for all three types of defect focus the jury on the time at which it left the plant, because that's when it has to be defective at that time, which is another problem with the idea of saying, well, we're going to call.
I think what the justices are getting at is the jury was given, you know, these two competing, you know, theories, and maybe there were others, but one, the defense theory was that it was a tire puncture that caused it, and the other was that there was a defect at the time it left the manufacturer. And shouldn't we presume that the jury chose based on, and you can argue about the evidence, but the jury chose the theory that says it was defective when it left the manufacturer, which makes your requested instruction not relevant to the ultimate outcome of the case. It would make it harmless error.
Well, this court has said that hasn't been argued, so I apologize. I can't remember the name of the case. I can give it to the court. But the court has said in several opinions, including one involving submission of both improper or legally improper and legally proper theories, that you can't presume that the jury picked the right one.
Castile.
But the question is, there are only two here. I take your point that if there was evidence of design defect and marketing defect, if you don't distinguish between the two in the charge, then I see your point that there's a problem, that they could find marketing defect when really they found design defect, but without finding the predicate requirements, no safer alternative. But if that's not in this case, then how is there harm? That's the difficulty.
Design defect is in the case. We attach that testimony to the reply brief, and it came in, and there it was. There was also argument that tires should last regardless of how they are treated until their tread runs out.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike McKenna will be presenting argument from the respondent.
I would ask for a minute's opportunity to talk about planned output. And during that time, to suggest an area that can use this court's advice and guidance without any change to the outcome of this case. Planned output. Let us suppose that one bought a Toyota and on driving applied the brake and had a fatal accident because there was no brake liner. If the evidence were clear that Toyotas ordinarily are intended to have a brake liner, the showing of a variance or deviation from planned output could occur without any specifications, without any blueprints, without any formulas, without any design standards. That is the proof of planned output and deviation from planned output can occur without any of the things that were proposed in the tendered incorrect jury instruction below.
Is that in this case?
The planned output?
Yes.
Yes. We have, in fact, the most telling to me of the agreement between the parties about intended planned output is in footnote 4 of the reply brief. The intended output is that the vulcanization process at the time of manufacture was sufficient to achieve adhesion of the second belt and tread to the carcass. That is in everybody's testimony, and Cooper even says that is what all the experts agree to, and if there is a showing, let me later turn to whether the showing was made. If there is a showing that that is the planned output, that showing is made.
How does that differ from design of specifications, from the specifications themselves, if there's no proof that the manufacturing did not deviate from the specifications? if the planned output depends on the specifications, isn't that a design defect?
My point was to say it does not depend on the specification. That is, 99.99% of Cooper tires do not have a failure of adhesion. That if we have an aspirin bottle and somebody buys it and dies of arsenic poisoning, we don't need to look at what is the design standards. What is the blueprint formula specifications if we prove that the planned output, non-lethal, non-arsenic product, existed at the time it left the plant? So the point is, if one found that there was factually sufficient and legally sufficient evidence persuasive to a jury, that this tire, when it left the plant, failed to have adhesion. That is, that the vulcanization process had failed to have adhesion, unlike all of its sister products. If the evidence were that, then just as the arsenic, just as the missing brake liner, just as here, we would not need to have additional evidence of how did the arsenic get in if we could prove it happened at manufacture. How did the liner get missing if we proved it was in that fashion at time of manufacture?
How does your argument change if, as petitioners argue, there are other agents acting on this product to cause
yes.
it to have problems?
And I think Ms. Molina's properly described that Section 3 of the restatement is not addressed here, would be with a new tire, the question that was asked earlier, and that there was evidence to rule out all other indicators. But the important thing to me, Justice Wainwright, is that there was direct evidence of markers that indicate that at the time of manufacture, at least two things failed to occur, which two things would not have failed had there been adhesion during vulcanization. One is liner marks. One is brassiness in the brass overlaying the steel coat that's necessary and through the copper sulfide process blackens instead of being shiny or brassy.
What evidence was there apart from the testimony that those two conditions showed what they showed? What evidence was there, independent of the experts, that said, oh, yes, indeed, these are markers for a defect, a flaw, tire separation, whatever?
That is, other than the pure say-so of the experts, one is that there was an in-court demonstration showing how line markers can occur on unvulcanized rubber in ways that do not unvulcanize. So one way was an in-court demonstration. Another was a book that is textbook used for the last 22 years by police academies, by forensic scientist schools. There's criticism. They say a man named Mr. Sachs has criticized one aspect of that book concerning underinflation issues, but that's in existence and is used in training. Now, it happens that it was written by the expert who says so, Justice Heck, you're testing, and yet it's something that is used for a training purpose and has been in a first and second edition for more than two decades. So it's not a mere say-so, I've made it up for the purpose of this litigation, and please trust me. This is one where we have a person who spent a career. I'm reminded of the beekeeper. We don't need an aeronautical engineer to tell us how bees behave if we have a beekeeper with sufficient experience. This court's description here, we have the beekeeper who has written the book and taught the classes and taught every police academy within the United Kingdom and I guess it says England and Ireland. We have somebody with decades of being entrusted by the leading tire manufacturer in England. His department was to analyze every returned tire and determine what are our problems so we can improve quality control. This is the person who has the hands-on to learn the markers and wrote about it and taught about it, and people sign up for his. But there is one criticism in a footnote by a Mr. S.A.C.H.S. about a part of the book, but that does not change the concern a court, a gatekeeper would have about is this mere say-so.
But he said, Mr. Grogan said, that there was some disagreement about the shiny
coworker, whatever
he acknowledged. Yes, he acknowledged that there were people among tire manufacturers who disagreed, but there is not a single published item that disagreed. We have the text that's used by all these police instructions that supports his view. But, Justice Heck, you have properly recited the testimony that existed. If we take planned output as our standard to look at, and go back to the question on jury charge, and if we take planned output as our standard to look at and go to the evidence, I think we can walk through and see two things. Justice Heck, I saw the... No, okay.
No.
I'm sorry. That's the jury charge. Most of you have the recollection from your years as a trial judge that there are often enthusiastic offers of truthful statements of the law that your litigants would like to add in to the charge, hoping to balance it a little bit this way or that way. That's not an unusual experience. And the pattern jury charge was intended to balance, though I do not claim that it is right merely because it says so. But I want to test with this. If there is somebody using pattern jury and somebody else wishes different language, which can be permissible, there are normally three things you would scrutinize as you reviewed that conduct. You would scrutinize first under Rule 278 in the case of a definition. The only tender here was a definition. It was not at trial an objection to a missing element. The only claim here, when you look at the charge conference, was a claim that there should have been an additional definition and a tender of one. Rule 278. Threshold one, was there a tender of a substantially accurate instruction? Tender of question two, if there was, did the trial judge abuse discretion in declining the tender? Question three, if there was a proper tender and an abuse of discretion, was it harmful error? Here we don't get past number one. The tendered instruction omitted planned output. The tendered instruction was not an accurate statement of the law. The tendered instruction was contrary to the most recent two Supreme Court opinions on that matter, Torrington and American Tobacco. And the tendered instruction was strategic. It intentionally left out planned output. Why do I say strategic? We have the system, as you know, right or wrong, that jury submissions and charges are put together at the close of the evidence when you've had a pretty good look at what got in and what did not. Suppose I had a pretty good look and my opponent had put in no specifications, and I could persuade the judge to say, you must show a deviation from specifications, period, left out or planned output. Strategically, I might be susceptible of trouble on review, but strategically, I may want to get that inaccurate statement of the law in charge so that I could argue, ladies and gentlemen, it was a tragedy for the Duran family and the Mendez family to lose their loved ones. Cooper deeply regrets that, but the judge has told you, you can only say yes if there was a deviation from specifications, and these lawyers never brought any specifications. That was a strategic choice to abbreviate and only ask whether there was a deviation from blueprints or design standards, period.
Should jurors be allowed to bring in outside treatises, outside expert reports, or dictionaries?
No, a jury should not be allowed to do that. Justice, the question here is where does one draw the line? Because jurors should not. If there were ever a case where an outside source influenced that, and especially if a party, but if there were an outside source that influenced that, we have a mechanism, and we balance the public policy of where will we draw the lines on those mechanisms to make sure that we can test that and find the consequence and have proper treatment at the trial level reviewable elsewhere. Let us suppose some examples. Suppose in jury deliberations, I was in a jury last September, two lawyers messed up and forgot to strike me. Suppose in jury deliberations, one of the 12 people were to say, you know, I read in the dictionary that negligent means such and such. We're all very clear that that simply cannot be attacked, even though that's not what they're supposed to be doing. Are you with me? Suppose a juror came and said, last night I was at home looking in the dictionary, and here's what it said. That, again, is not something that our method allows unless there's been an exterior influence, a non-juror saying, by the way, Mike, why don't you look at this dictionary definition and see what you think about it? If there were a non-juror exterior influence, then, Justice Medina, that would be something that the trial court could measure. The trial court could make findings as to whether that had a harmful influence on the outcome. In the absence of request for findings, that would be deemed to support the judgment. But the policy choices this court has made in rejecting expansions to the rules of what can the jury testify, the choices this court has made not liberalizing how many things could attack, forecloses, in our judgment, forecloses this matter. If it hadn't been foreclosed, there still is a deemed finding problem that this trial judge did not find that there was any harmful. And frankly, we quoted the definition within the negligence. As to one of those three items, I offer it to you the next time the pattern jury is promulgated because it is practically the same that you can understand what it says.
Tender would be correct if it had or planned output or not?
Then I think it would have been a correct tender. It would not mean it was required by the judge to accept it, as in any, it's simply a definition of a term, manufacturing defect. There is in pattern jury a definition of the word defect. And then a juror is advised, use your ordinary understanding of language for undefined terms. The word manufacturing defect has the word manufacturing in front of a defined term. One could understand a trial judge making the choice that I'm going to put it in. I think in the facts of this case, that would be a helpful balance of truthful statements of the law. But you could also understand a trial judge saying, I think in the facts of this case, the word defect is adequately defined. It has to be at the time of manufacture. It has to be unreasonably dangerous. And I don't have to also call it a flaw. I don't have to use extra synonyms. That's a discretionary decision by a trial court. I think pattern jury is always available to review it. But to say that that was error when it was not properly tendered, to say that it was error when it's an abuse of discretion standard, to say that it was reversible, let alone the prayer for render, when that is something that is not shown to have any harmful effect on the facts of this case, I think would be improper. But, Mr. Chief Justice, I think it is fair for a trial judge to make a contrary decision and to put in from Torrington, from American Tobacco, from Ridgeway, from Bridgestone Firestone, that phrase, but it must say or planned output. That's the concurrence that Ms. Justice O'Neill emphasized, that planned output and that the majority opinion of the opinion of the court emphasized. You can often make these findings by inspecting the product.
Mr. Ricchetta, if jumping back to the alleged jury misconduct.
Yes.
If we disagree with you, and if this court finds that the dictionary with an outside influence impermissible,
yes,
should be looked at, what should this court do? Should we send it back to the Court of Appeals or the trial court, or what should be the remedy there?
Here are three things that I know that you would want to consider, the end of which would be a remand to the Court of Appeals. I may be mistaken on that, perhaps, but let me walk through the things that I think you would want to look at first. The primary one would be, was there any harm by that conduct? In other words, look at the so-called outside influence and read the definitions and see, did that appear in the facts of this case to cause harm? That's ordinarily a balancing test that Golden Eagle says we treat as a finding of fact by the trial judge. The trial judge here was asked to review that matter, and any deemed findings as to harmfulness are ordinarily deemed to support the judgment. I believe, Mr. Justice Willett, that on the facts of this case, one would find no outside influence, but to your question, if one found outside influence, one would find no unfairness or harm by that. If there were doubt by this court, that's really a fact-finding role, was there, that would be a trial judge matter. And I think that I have gone on and on with an answer.
Mr. Rosso here offered no sort of on-the-record views on why he denied the motion for a new trial.
I recall none. I cannot say there were none, but I cannot recall an on-the-record answer.
And you argue that there's no record evidence showing that any juror voted any differently based on the introduction of this dictionary definition?
That's right, but ordinarily you don't do that by interviewing 12 jurors. Ordinarily you do that by staying in the facts of this case. Was this a matter that was so influential to a highly contested matter that it needs, each of the former trial judges have done this many times, and that is ordinarily a fact-finding rather than a legal sufficiency review that this court ordinarily, I would think, would entertain. In the event that the court agrees, I do just want to blurt out, because somebody surely was going to ask me about wax.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, and maybe I didn't catch Ms. Molinas's statement accurately, but I thought she said that you had specifications sufficient to allow you to prove a deviation.
She has claimed that in her briefing. Our briefing said, show us that in the record. I was not at the trial and have the benefit of the record, not the benefit of her recollections about discovery. So the record does not reflect to my reading what she says. But I do say, even if we had the specs, that was not necessary for us to show a deviation from planned output. I want to just mention wax and mention a page. In volume 25, for a dozen pages or so, starting at page 40, a chemist who would not be a good person to ask questions about tire repair, but according to the San Antonio court that said you can't answer tire questions, would be a good person to talk about adhesion and chemical processes. That's in the San Antonio court decision. Crate, for 12 pages, talks about his eight principles gleaned from four learned articles that he quotes by name. The record is produced, available. The record is Cooper never chose to have their witnesses read them. There's nobody saying that he misapplied any of those principles of those four articles, and lays out eight principles talking about migration of wax and why it cannot be that Cooper's theory that the contaminant, unnecessary for us to prove if planned output means adequate adhesion, it's just more information about how that happened, but unnecessary to prove that the contaminant was in fact wax that did not belong and did not migrate. And he does it, you'll see, by looking at 20 carbon to 38 carbon chains and rates of migration and diffusion. It's very sophisticated, and I didn't feel right not mentioning it for those of you who wish to study the science. Thank you very
Justice
much.
Justice Wainwright has a question.
Question in the charge asks about manufacturing defect. The definition and instruction refer only to defect.
Correct.
So then according to the logic of your argument, the question could have excluded the word manufacturing and it would have been fine here.
Oh, no. I argued poorly, Justice Wainwright, as I often do. What I meant to say was the word
if the question asks about manufacturing defect,
yes,
and the definition only defines a defect.
And the standard instructions tell the jurors, where a word has not been defined, use your common understanding of the term. So
they
the word
bring
manufacturing
a
is itself in the question.
But they can bring a dictionary in and talk about it.
And Mr. Justice Medina, they did not bring a dictionary in for that.
So the jury gets its understanding of how a manufacturing defect is different from other types of defect. In a case where we're told, I haven't read the record yet, is evidence of design as well as manufacturing defect. Where does the jury get their understanding of how manufacturing defect is different from general defect?
From the charge. From the instruction to use commonly used words as you understand them.
From the charge.
Mr. Justice Wainwright, in the event there's
a
proper
just
a
second.
Tender,
from the charge.
I really do want to answer the question. Go ahead.
Okay. You said your first answer was from the charge.
Yes.
Where in the charge does it explain to the jury how a manufacturing defect is different from a general defect?
On a properly tendered extra definition, a party could ask the judge to give one more definition if it's an accurate statement of the law. It is, in my judgment, not an abuse of discretion to leave this undefined, and there have been thousands and thousands of lawsuits tried with this instruction in ways that juries truly do reach results that have been deemed fair. But I'm not saying that it would be wrong to have a sentence.
Let me stop you there. So in this case, with this charge, where does a jury get its understanding of how manufacturing defect is different from a general defect?
What they heard in this case, they saw the word manufacturing. They saw what a defect is, a condition. It has to be a condition existing at the time it left and causes unreasonable danger. And they heard both sides' experts say that there should be adhesion at the time of vulcanization, and they heard many instances of tires that did not fail. This was a tire whose planned output deviated from those of all the others and was a very easy basis for saying that's the manufacturing defect that we spent these, I think it was 5 or 6 weeks talking about.
And you are going to give me a list of a few other things, I think, before I cut you off.
I think you finally allowed me to intersperse each one of those.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Justice Wendell.
Thank you, Mr. McKeb.
Well, first, let's get out of the way the propriety of the instruction that I tendered. Planned output simply was not part of this case for a number of reasons. First off, there's no evidence at all that this tire differed from the sister tires that were on the vehicle. And so, except for the nail hole, that's the only difference. Secondly, there's no evidence of deviation from any planned output, except he's saying, well, there's planned output is no failure. There should be no failure of adhesion. Well, the experts all testify that there can be, quote, failure of adhesion for a variety of reasons. It can be, like I said in that footnote, that if the problem is that your curing machine didn't work, that's a manufacturing problem, and the other tires that are made on another day when the machine works should be different from it. If the tire doesn't fuse, in their words, fused together, because the curing spec doesn't have an adequate temperature, time, or pressure, that's a design defect, where they have to come up by statute with evidence of an alternative design. And it is very important, because in Texas, deviation from specifications is an element of the manufacturing defect claim. Question doesn't submit the element. You can't assume it was there simply because there was some evidence to support it. The jury doesn't know that it had to find it.
Where has this court held that a deviation from spec is an essential element in a defect case?
Because in the cases that differentiate between the different types of defect, by definition, a manufacturing defect is a deviation from specifications or planned output. And I think the planned output language is just another way of saying specifications, because whether you say a roach isn't supposed to be in the orange juice because it's not in the spec, or the manufacturer didn't intend for the roach to be in the orange juice, it says the same thing. So I've always viewed the planned output language as just another way of saying the same thing. Now, as far as the, I think my time is up.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess. All rise.